Court Standards of Review. This is Brock.
And this is John.
And we are going to talk about Delaware case law mostly, and you want to listen to the podcast about fiduciary duties if you want to hear John and I discuss why Delaware is an important business law court. So for the first question for you, John, is what is Revlon all about?
Revlon is shorthand for a doctrine that was first announced by the Delaware Supreme Court, I think in 1985, in a case called Revlon versus McAndrews and Forbes. And it's laid out in this case and a handful of subsequent cases. Revlon says that before we get to a business judgment standard of review, when we're talking about a change of control transaction, we're going to impose some additional obligations on the board of directors. The board's going to have to act reasonably. The board's going to have to demonstrate that it's acted reasonably to maximize immediate shareholder value in those situations. So the burden is on the board to demonstrate that they've fulfilled this obligation before a court's going to defer to their business judgment. Typically, you go to court in other situations, and the board's business judgment is the standard that applies going in. Here, there are some hurdles that the board has to cross over before it gets to the business judgment standard. So there's a sort of a heightened level of scrutiny that the courts apply when Revlon comes into play. And when does it come into play? When a company actively pursues a change of control transaction, where in response to an unsolicited takeover proposal, it pursues an alternative that involves a breakup of the company, or when it engages in any transaction involving a change in control. Now, it's been 30 years, and people still noodle the parameters of this, but change in control generally includes a sale of the company for cash, or mostly cash, a transaction in which control of the company is going to pass from the market to a controlling shareholder, regardless of the form of consideration that's paid, essentially, the reasons for Revlon are that it's tied to control premium. It's the one chance that the shareholders of the company are going to get to extract the control premium. So under those circumstances, what the courts essentially say is, look, the focus has to be on maximizing immediate shareholder value. Looking long-term and saying, oh, gee, this combination may be great in the long-term for these companies and generate all sorts of long-term value, that one doesn't make an awful lot of sense in the context where this is the one chance for a control premium. You've got to focus on immediate shareholder value in a Revlon transaction. And that's really what distinguishes it from transactions where Revlon doesn't apply. When Revlon doesn't apply, the board can continue to think long term, and what's the classic example of that? Well, a stock for stock transaction that involves situations where control of the company was in the market before the deal and after the deal. Those typically don't they generally don't trigger Revlon obligations.
So, how does that compare to the Unocal doctrine?
Unocal is another decision from the mid-1980s, Delaware Supreme Court. It's Unocal versus Mesa Petroleum. It's a very important case because it represented Delaware's resolution of a debate that went on in the 70s and 80s about whether the board had a role to play in unsolicited tender offers. As you may recall from the 1980s, was kind of the birth of the hostile takeover, and you had companies that were launching tender offers for shareholders, going directly to shareholders, bypassing boards that typically have the say over whether there's a merger or not, and attempting to gain control of the company in that fashion. There's no statutory role for a board in a tender offer. It's essentially a decision from the stockholder to sell its shares to a bidder. So the question became, under what circumstances could the board insert itself into an offer that was made directly to the shareholders? What the Unocal court said was there is a role for the board, but before the court's going to countenance any action that was taken by the board to defend against a tender offer, the board needed to identify a threat to an important corporate policy or corporate effectiveness, and the defensive action had to be reasonable and proportionate in relation to the threat posed. Unocal supposedly applies only to unilateral board action, like adoption of a poison pill defense, and it would not apply, for example, to a shareholder approval of a amendment to charter documents that might have some sort of anti-takeover effect. And over the years, Unocal was extended to encompass not just actions that the board took in response to a hostile bid, but efforts to promote and protect a a board-favored transaction. Deal protection devices like breakup fees, no-shop clauses, et cetera, included in merger agreements could be subject to review under the UNICAL standard. And like I think you think of it as Rev, same thing as Revlon. There's sort of an intermediate level of scrutiny here, not quite as demanding as Revlon, but before you get to the business judgment rule, you have to show that your actions are taken in response to a threat and that they're reasonable and proportionate. And you know, that was sort of fleshed out in later cases to mean reasonable and proportionate, not preclusive or coercive of shareholders' ability to ultimately make a choice.
How does that compare to the entire fairness standard?
Yeah, entire fairness. There's all sorts of standards of review that come into play in Delaware, and it's very difficult to keep track of them sometimes. But what entire fairness is basically the answer to the question, what happens if you screw up the duty of care or the duty of loyalty? If you breach your fiduciary duties, then the court's going to say, well, sorry, the business judgment rule doesn't apply here, and the burden's going to now shift to the board of directors to establish the fairness of the transaction. And in establishing the fairness, the court's going to look at both the price that was paid in the deal and the process by which that transaction came to be. This is also, by the way, the standard that applies to transactions between the company and its controlling shareholder in certain situations, and also transactions in which a majority of the board has an interest. In these situations, the business judgment rule also doesn't apply.
And I think you've already touched on this, but how are courts evolving their approach to Revlon cases?
Yeah, it used to be that if a plaintiff established at the pleading stage a claim that the board violated its Revlon duties, a court would very frequently enjoin that transaction to address the issues that were raised by the plaintiff. And this typically resulted either in an increase in the price paid, some additional disclosure, perhaps taking down some of the defensive measures that were associated with the deal. And it usually culminated in a pre-closing settlement where there was an increase in the purchase price and payment to the plaintiff's lawyers and the deal itself, or an alternative involving a competing suitor, got done. Now it's really kind of changed in recent years. If there's no competing bid floating around out there, the Delaware courts are very reluctant to grant injunctions. They're much more inclined to allow transactions with Revlon issues, potential Revlon issues, to move forward to a vote and then address the claims in a post-closing damage action, which, because of some recent Delaware case law, the Corwin case in particular, may result in a very different result for a plaintiff than might have been the case just a few years back.
And how about Corwin? Can you talk about that case and how that's impacted?
Yeah, sure. The Corwin case basically says that fully informed, uncoerced shareholder approval is going to result in the application of the business judgment rule to post-closing damage claims that would otherwise be subject to Revlon's heightened scrutiny. It really is a dramatic change in the Delaware landscape. The decision was made in 2015, and there's been seven or eight cases since then that keep reiterating that yes, this is really what it means. That if we have a fully informed, uncoerced shareholder vote, where you've basically the board has come clean about the transaction and fully disclosed all the material facts about it and any potential issues that were raised in it, that shareholder vote will cleanse the transaction and cleanse folks from the Revlon heightened scrutiny that would otherwise otherwise apply. Now, what's interesting is it's not entirely clear about what the effect of Corwin might be on UNICAL. I actually had an exchange with Stan Keller not too long ago, where he pointed out to me that there's been some Delaware case law saying we haven't reached UNICAL yet. My view initially was, gee, they've come so far on the effect of shareholder ratification on Revlon that it would certainly be surprising to me if UNICAL, with this sort of an intermediate standard of review, if that didn't get cleansed as well. But Stan pointed out, deal protections that are coercive of shareholder choice under UNICAL, coercion is a big thing with the Corwin doctrine, and they may be a tough fit within Corwin's path to business judgment review. So the question of its application to UNICAL is uncertain.
Christoph, thanks.
You're welcome.